background of, okay.
So we were having a meeting, a trustee meeting, and I got the three of them to the side, and I said, something's going to come up. You're going to hear something come up at this meeting that I feel very strongly about. And I did feel very strongly about it. And I said, we're making a huge mistake in my personal view. We're going to let this property go by the wayside. BMI will buy it. It's not that their man is going to find a buyer. It's just that he's given us the opportunity. And John and Jim, John Wilson and Jim Bouncy, aren't that interested in it. And I think that's a criminal mistake. And I hope we'll get it. And so they agreed with me. And they immediately said, well, what if we offer to buy it for the university? And I said, well, I can't imagine then that the trustees would turn it down. It's a gift. Why would they turn it down? And that's exactly what happened. The issue came up at the trustee meeting. It came up because it was a significant enough offer that I think President Wilson and Jim Bouncy, the rector, felt like the board should know. And but they also said that we just aren't going to acquire it. At that point, my little friends raised their hand and said, we'll buy it for you. And so we got that house. Now, it became important in the Lentes story because it was that house that Frank Parsons was talking about in his great talk to the 35th reunion class, of the class of 1953. Their 35th reunion in 1988. Now you're going to know the rest of the story because that's what most people pick up. They don't know the background. But Frank was talking about a gift that a member of that class had made. And Lenfest is in the audience because what happened was that Gray, in the final analysis, said to Ted Van Leer and to Bill Lemon, look, I want the privilege of doing the whole house. Linda and I want to make that gift of that house to the university ourselves. And so the others backed away, and Gray did it. And so Frank, in making the talk to the 35th reunion class banquet, I think it was, mentioned that a member of the class had made this wonderful gift. Well, the purchase price turned out to be about $250,000 or something, about that number. And then Lenfest, after the speech, said to Frank, if you ever have something akin to that kind of a need come up again, I hope you will let me know. And Frank was thinking $250,000, as I'm sure you have heard. And at that time, that was the price, the cost of what was going to be this track, all-weather track around Wilson Field. We had the cinder track there, and it was the last cinder track in North America. Every high school in the state of Texas has an all-weather track, but Washington University didn't. And so that was how that happened. And Lenfest said to Frank, Frank said, well, we want $250,000 to do this track. And Jerry says, well, I had something more significant in mind. Aren't you trying to build a theater? And Frank says, well, yeah, but that's a $3 million shortfall there. And Jerry just didn't blink an eye and said, we'll send the president up to see him next week. So that's how that all happened. And but I don't think to this minute, you can send this tape to John. John Wilson would be amazed to know that my little finger was in the gift of the house that caused Jerry to...
What's that house used for?
Well, right now we have a professor up there, but it has been used in the 7 or 8 years now. It's been 8 years. That's where Randy Bazanson was used to attract the new dean of the law school. So the Bazansons lived there when they first came to town. After them, Michael Walsh, the new athletic director at the time. At one point, Litzenberg lived there. So it's been used early on as a place in effect, attract. It's a wonderful house. And I would love to have had it. Oh, after we got, I'm still finished the story. After we did get the house and the university was gifted the house by Gray Castle, it was now in our possession. So I went to the president. I said, John, now that we own that, I still hadn't told him what my little part had been in Drake Hassel's decision to give it to us. But I said, you know, it truly is right there. We've got all the parking. And I said, could we write into the contract and the rental arrangement with whoever you put in there, you know, that I can use the house with the alumni program a couple of times a year for like homecoming and spring reunions and things. It's a marvelous place, and I can just see blue and white tents all over the lawn, and great part is out here, and your parking is all worked out. And he said, no, James. So he never let me use it the way I wanted to. But that house, to this minute, I think I can make a case for its institutional use, the grounds thereof. Of course, I felt strongly about it, and I'm sure Frank and Farris and others did too early on, because it is so close to Liberty Hall. It is absolutely within spitting distance of the great cradle and the great origins of this university. And the thought that we couldn't control that property was driving me up the wall and causing me to do things behind people's backs that I shouldn't do. But I really felt that, and of course that a little bit relates to all my years in Williamsburg. One thing you learn there, and of course it's a great, that whole Rockefeller organization there and the way it all the real estate was acquired there, a great American example of acquiring property. If you can control it and it's contiguous to your property, whatever the price is, you go get it. Now, that's just something you learn in that business, and particularly if you have any sense of the history and the preservation, the whole, all that. Jim Bouncy said to me one time, damn it, Sessions, you're always trying to get us to buy some old house. I feel just as strongly about the old Sigma Phi Epsilon house that the university let go a year and a half ago, which now a private owner has come in and beautifully restored. It's an elegance, restored it to its elegance, and I think that's criminal. I think the university has had a very spotty record. We've done well to preserve the historic national landmark, but in terms of some things that were close to the university that we didn't do, that house that I'm talking about now is the house that the Civil War poetess Junkin described, Margaret Junkin described the bombing of VMI from that front porch. She wrote that poem or whatever.
For posterity, where is this house?
Well, it's at the end of Lee Avenue and the intersection today of Lee and Preston Street. And next to the Phi Gamma House, and it had been in recent years the Sigma Phi Epsilon House. And I thought it'd make a wonderful faculty club. I would have taken it in a heartbeat and considered making a sorority house too. I mean, there are just a lot of uses for a house that size.
You know, and what? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt.
No.
You know who'd be interested in probably helping out with the faculty club is Jack Warner.
Yeah, okay.
He took me to lunch last week at the University Club in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah.
He's very proud of that.
Yeah, well, we don't have a faculty. The alumni house tends to be the closest thing we have to a faculty house. It's just only a few of the faculty maybe go over and drink coffee every morning, but our faculty ought to have that kind of facility. We built one of the great teaching faculties in the country, and that's the sort of thing that I hope as we evolve we will think about doing. It's not a high priority, and it's the sort of thing that you have to find a donor, someone that really wants you to have that for your faculty. But that particular house, because it is so historic, it's the, you know, General Preston of VMI owned that property. I mean, what this just absolutely floors me is that sometimes it is possible for a college as even as old as ours and as mature as we are in many ways to make decisions in boardrooms without full knowledge of the history of what we're dealing with. And I felt like in the case of that particular house, the Board of Trustees were not aware of its history. Had they been aware of the house's history, they might have felt a little bit more precious about selling it. And people make decisions to sell things without knowledge, without the knowledge of that history. So
now you mentioned much earlier that there were things you learned in Williamsburg that you put to work here.
Yeah.
Now I presume this is one of the things.
Well,
are there other things that you learned there?
The last few minutes been talking about my great interest in preservation and in preserving old things and having a feeling for old things. But yeah, I went to Williamsburg as a staff writer in their press section and had a wonderful experience dealing with radio and television as well as the writing press. Because of its international and national standing, you know, or whatever you want to call the attention that Williamsburg received, I was coming from a little PR job in Lexington, Virginia, working with the Roanoke newspaper and the Richmond Times-Dispatch and the Washington Post, maybe at the highest possible level, and local radio and TV stations, and you go to work for the public relations staff of Colonial Williamsburg, and suddenly you're dealing with the National Geographic and the New York Times and network television, and it was moving to a whole different league. And I had a wonderful mentor there who was a former Nieman fellow with Clark Molyneux, of all people. My boss down there was a fellow named Don Gonzales. And Don had been president of the White House Correspondents Association and president of the, I guess it was in those days, the State Department of Correspondents. And my big boss there, the president of Colonial Williamsburg, Carl Hummelstein, had worked under five secretaries of state and had been on General Marshall's staff in World War II, the youngest colonel in the Second World War for the United States Army. So I had some pretty strong people to learn from my whole 15 years there. And for whatever reason, they took me under their wing, but I was given a lot of responsibility at a very tender age and became, after a couple of years in the press area where I had done such things as coordinate, one time I coordinated the Barbara Walters, Hugh Downs television special in Williamsburg, 2-hour show that emanated there. Well, I did a lot of funny things. Once I worked on the Lassie television show, Lassie even visited Williamsburg. But I had a lot of interesting experience working with writers from around the country and the world, lots of film crews and lots of magazine writers and photographers of every kind.
And how have you brought that experience
well,
to Washington?
Just general public relations background and making decisions. I was if you get me on the Williamsburg stuff, I'll go all night, but
that's why I'm pulling you back to Washington.
Yeah, right. Bring me back to but I guess maybe the most specific thing, just beyond the general PR experience there, seeing the big picture, probably the greatest thing I learned there. Know the detail, but always keep the big picture in mind. And in terms of detail, the one job that I had there that I can absolutely have applied to my Washington Lee experience was that for 9 or 10 years I was director of special events at Williamsburg. Now, in terms of special events, I have to talk a bit about that, and then I'll bring it back to Washington Lee. But there, for example, I was in charge of, over my years, the visits of something like 60 or 70 visiting foreign heads of state. I worked with the State Department and the White House on visits of, and, well, let me think, Hirohito, the Shah of Iran, 3 or 4 times, King Hussein, Sadat, presidents, prime ministers of all these countries. And I was the first person that worked. I mean, I was the person that got the phone call from the State Department. Dick, we want to bring President so-and-so or Prime Minister so-and-so. And can you make the arrangements? So in making the arrangements for everything from dietary, for meals, menus, I wrote the operations plan, in other words, for the visits of those sorts of people. You learn an awful lot when you do that. You work with embassies. You work with the State Department. You have to do a lot of research on the country that you're entertaining. And of course, we were a great stopping place on the visits, on official visits to Washington. So I worked many, many nights, and I can't tell you, with Secret Service about security matters. One of my proudest, I guess, possessions is an award I got from the Secret Service when I left Williamsburg. They don't give many of those, but I've got a wonderful award from the Secret Service. In any event, the detail of planning all that and planning such things as the Williamsburg Forum Series, that, within my job description, I also handled the Antiques Forum, the horticultural event, the Williamsburg Garden Symposium, and I handled board meetings there. In other words, I did the logistical detail, just like Ferris Hoskins does at the Wash League trustee meetings. I made the arrangements for board dinners, for evenings at Carter's Grove, you know, so I had to develop after dinner entertainment, not only for the Prime Minister of Australia, but for our own board of trustees. Now let me tell you, the Williamsburg Board of Trustees is a pretty powerful group of people. We had a lot of people on there that remain friends of mine. Not to digress too much, but last night I happened to watch this wonderful program on David Brinkley and his great career that this wonderful journalist and the impact he's had on television. Well, it just so happened that David Brinkley was a trustee of Colonial Williamsburg. In fact, I handled his wedding, his second wedding. I did all the arrangements for David's and Susan's wedding. The other time I've been a wedding consultant was I did the same thing for young Winthrop Rockefeller. So if you handle a Rockefeller wedding and written I'm talking about everything from doing the, not the bridesmaids' dresses, but I did have to get the tuxedos and the morning coats not for all of his groomsmen because they were all flying in from all over the world. So I've had those kinds of experiences. Now, what did that mean to Washington Lee? Very few people up here really know what I did down there. Ferris knows. I think there are a few people up here that know what I did down there. But I guess the quickest example I could give you would be when it came time for us to do the campaign for Washington and Lee, this most recent campaign that I was
on the shoulders of
on
Giants.
The shoulders of Giants. Mm-hmm. I think I'm the person that said, well, we've got to start at Mount Vernon. That was my idea. I was very much in favor of taking something I wanted to call the Treasures of Washington Lee on the Road, a traveling exhibition. Well, we didn't have the wherewithal to do it as big as I wanted to do it, but a piece of my idea did get involved. That is to say, taking the old George statue and the two portraits. All this was part of a larger concept that I had to engender the kind of spirit that I wanted to have around the country and all these things. I would never have come up with those sorts of ideas had I not had those 15 years in Williamsburg where that sort of thing was my job. We routinely did things of that nature. Another example might be probably one of the best alumni events that I will remember that I did in my 7 years over in the alumni office was once we did a big reception at the Swiss Embassy in Washington. And that's a great story in itself. I'm going to tell you because it's a funny story. It's a good story. Professor Doyon in our art department had made me aware several years before this came up of a painting of Robert E. Lee by a Swiss artist named Frank Buxer. Buxer had painted Lee from life only the third time General Lee posed for a picture. And the Buxer painting of Lee had been done in 1867, I believe it was, or 68, or maybe it was 69 even, but it was before the general died, of course. And the Swiss government had sent this famous artist over to paint American heroes, and he was in Washington painting everybody, generals and so forth, and people in Washington said, well, you've got to go to this little town, Lexington, Virginia, to Washington College and paint General Lee. So he came down and painted Lee, and Lee and he got off a good start, and Lee, I guess, enjoyed posing for it and whatnot. Well, the painting, completed painting, went back to Switzerland right then and there, because it had been commissioned by the Swiss, and it resided for 100 and some odd years in the Swiss National Museum in Bern, I think it is. Well, I happened to pick up the paper one day and see that a new ambassador had been named and had arrived in Washington, and the Swiss had sent over a man named Brunner. And Ambassador Brunner, it so happened, had brought this painting of Lee. Okay, now I have that information. He's got the painting of Lee. It's only the third painting, the only, you know, of Lee from life. We've got the Benjamin West, I guess, down in the Tilly Chapel, and there's one other. But so I called Ambassador Brunner, and it took a little temerity, I guess, to do that. But I called him, and I said, Ambassador Brunner, I got through to him. First of all, it's hard to get through to ambassador somewhere, but sometimes, but I knew how to do that. And I said, I'm Dick Sessoms. I'm director of the alumni program at Washington University. And I'd like to talk to you about something, an idea I've had that would involve your embassy. And, of course, he said, well, what on earth is that? And I said, well, our university has developed a nice tradition of celebrating one of our patron saints' birthdays. So General Lee's birthday is January 19th every year, and we celebrate it. And our alumni all around America celebrate it with receptions, etc. And General Lee is a man who is greatly revered by the alumni of this institution. We have our largest alumni chapter in Washington. And I propose that you give us a reception and let us come see your painting, because we are fascinated to know that it's here and we would love to see it. And before you answer, let me tell you now what I'm going to do for you. We have in Washington a group of alumni that I personally promise I can deliver. And I'm going to just drop 8 or 10 names. But these are people I think that you would want to entertain. I'll start with the Supreme Court Justice Lewis F. Powell, Jr., the Washington correspondent Roger Mudd, and Charles McDowell, U.S. Senator John Warner, Robert E. Lee IV, a direct descendant of General Lee, and Secretary of the Army John Marsh. And I just kept going. Oh, it was the Commerce Secretary, Robert Mossbacher. So I dropped every name I could, former Governor Linwood Houlton. I just rolling them off. And I said, I promise you they will all be there. And incidentally, I made that happen. Every single one of them came, because I called them and wrote them and said, this is very important. I promise you, you've got to come. So he said, well, that sounds interesting. He said, suppose we do this on the 19th. Of course, I had the schedule for Friday night, and I think we'll do it here at my residence. And would 150 people be about right? And I wanted more, but I obviously I was going to accept whatever he was going to offer. So I said, oh, that would be wonderful. So I then wrote a letter to the, 1,300 alumni in that chapter. And I said, you're going to get an invitation in about a week. And it's a first come, first serve deal. You must respond quickly. And no exceptions made. First come, first serve, because we anticipate a heavy response. And this was a November letter I was writing, or December, and probably somewhere in late November I was writing a letter. And so the invitation went forward. And of course, I worked all this out with the embassy. They worked out the exact language for the invitation under the sponsorship of the ambassador of Switzerland, et cetera, et cetera. And the invitations arrived, and then the response came in. And on the very first day, we had 150 thereabout responses. I mean, first day, return mail. Second day, doubled that number. So I picked up the phone and called Ambassador Bruner. And I thought about this a long time, of course, before I made the call. Mind you, I hadn't cleared this with anybody down here. I mean, John Wilson was amazed to discover himself at the Swiss Embassy a month later, wondering how on the devil he got there. But anyway, so I called Ambassador Bruner, and I said, Ambassador Bruner, I have this wonderful response from this great party you're doing for us, and I have another proposal to make. And he said, well, what is that? And I said, I want to offer to pay for half of the party. And he said, why would you do that? I've already offered to do it. I said, well, Ambassador Bruner, I want to bring twice as many people. He said, okay. So now I was up to 300. And what I finally did, Mame, and again, this is based on my experience in Williamsburg a little bit, I doubled, I overbooked it. I think we wound up accepting 350 people. And it shook down to the 300 that we, because there's always a no-show factor, you know, particularly on,
especially January 19th.
Particularly in January. So the ambassador's social secretary could have killed me. She was a woman who had been there for a while, I guess, and boy, I was the last thing she needed. And but in working with them, I decided to pull back on some of my Williamsburg experience, so I called one of my dearest friends who was for many years under Richard Nixon and I guess in those Republican administrations, the assistant chief of protocol, a man named Bill Curtis. And I called Bill and I said, Bill, I want you to do me a big favor and go with me out to the Swiss embassy. So I took him with me. And of course, when you walk in with a protocol assistant chief, and as soon as he saw Bruner, well, that's right, they had met at Senator Mansfield's two nights earlier and whatnot, and we just overpowered the social secretary, who was about, I'm sure, going to kill me for bringing 300 people, because they had to move furniture, they had to do all these things for us. Anyway, to make a long story short, I think you can check, but there are plenty of alumni that are still talking about that Swiss Embassy party. It was perfect because it had everything that you wanted. It was first of all, there was a reason for it. The painting was everything. The interest was in the painting. The locale, even to our so-called jaded and sophisticated Washington alumni, hey, they were dying to get to the Swiss Embassy for a party. We had more than 700 people who wanted to come. And I dare say that there'll be a long time before we'll do another alumni event in D.C. that would draw 700 people. And so, would I have done that without the Williamsburg? No way. I would never have. In fact, people then said, how on earth did you, why? How could you have done that? I said, well, it starts with knowing what the ambassador's job is. Look, that ambassador could kiss me. Why? Because I got him a wonderful, I forgot to tell you, huge article in the Washington Post. Maxine Cheshire, one of the great society writers, came and did a huge article on this party and the Swiss embassy and the new ambassador. And, of course, it is his job to relationships with the American public. Okay, that's the only reason they've got an embassy there. So he, from his point of view, here comes the guy that's coming in with my kind of experience saying, I am going to bring all these wonderful people to your embassy for a party to see something you've got. So it was a master PR stroke for the Embassy of Switzerland, in addition to being a great alumni event for W&L. So that's a too long a story, but how it happened.
I'm just thrilled. That's
successful. No, well, yeah. Somebody, John Falk, the new president of the Washington chapter, had an event at the, I guess the Supreme Court building the other day. You know, John grew up in Northern Virginia and lived next door to Chief Justice Rehnquist and used to mow his lawn.
I wondered how that happened.
And so John was able to do an event that Barry Sullivan spoke in Washington at it, the Supreme Court the other day, and he called me up and said we had 250 or 275 people. It was a huge success. And he said, I got my greatest compliment came when one of the alums, someone up there said, this is a Sesame style event. And I said, well, that made my day too, to have you tell me that.
That's great.
But one of the things that I've learned about Washington alumni and in all this is that they do respond to quality in whatever form it takes. So whether it's quality in the events we do or in the way we do the magazine or the way we do anything here, our people expect us to do it well, and they respond best to imagination and some creativity. And so I've tried to apply that not only to the Washley alumni program, but to the development program and the so-called development events. And anyway, so that's you get me talking about this stuff, and maybe I'll be here all day.
Well, that was a good one. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit to talking about Washington and Lee here.
Mm.
You came in 1980. There were some things happening on this campus and around this campus that were not its finest day in 1980.
Yeah.
I was living here at that
time.
Yeah,
that's right, you were.
And it was not its finest day in some ways. Can you describe that?
Well, the fraternity scene was just totally out of control in 1980. I mean, there was a... In fact, sometimes when I think about the faculty today and they complaining about maybe too many parties or whatever, I say, gosh, you don't remember. You're suffering from a total memory loss. Now, it is so much improved today compared to the early 80s, it's mind-boggling. Maybe we don't want to tell the students that, but the fact is that we have things under greater control than we did in 1980. The thing that was, that was just out of control. But in the early 1980s, we had still some of the brightest students, brighter than we have today. Not across the board bright, but at the top of the pyramid, the kids in those days were just as bright as ever. And I think the university's decision to co-educate probably provided me with the greatest, maybe personal challenge of my 16 years.
Let's talk about that.
Well. In 1980, '03, John Wilson came as president, and in February of that year, I think, or March, maybe it was March, I became John's, I think, first significant appointment, because I was named to succeed Bill Washburn as alumni secretary in the spring of 1983. So I was, I guess, the first quote-unquote cabinet level, if you think of the Monday group, in those days known as the Monday Lunch Bunch, John's first appointment at that level. John probably saw something in me that he saw, not unlike himself, an immigrant maybe. He knew that I had gone to Hamden, Sydney. He knew that I had worked in Williamsburg, and John, I think, appreciated that background in Williamsburg. I guess I was being promoted by Ferris and others. I'd been here for 2.5 years. And when when Bill Washburn had resigned, resigned only because he was 65 years old and was retiring. I don't mean to say he left for any other reason. He'd been in the job for 25 years. But there had been a national search for his successor. And that's why I can tell my earlier story about not a Washington man would take that big a cut and pay to take that job. Because they had looked for almost a full year and had not come up with the person they wanted. I think they'd made an offer, one or two offers for all I know, but they just weren't coming up with the right person. In the meantime, Bob Huntley retired, the man that brought me here, really, and John Wilson was in the saddle now. And I think somewhere along the line, I got a phone call to come up and chat with John. And later turned out that was the conversation. I guess he was just trying to size me up a little bit, get to know me a bit better. But in the final analysis, Ferris later told me that, well, we decided that you had all the PR communications background, the skills, special events training, that job really could best use. So it was kind of dumb to say, well, just because he isn't an alum, we aren't going to think about him for that position. So you could have blown me over with a feather. It said a great deal about Washington Lee too that they would hire for a position like the alumni secretary a non-alumnus. So the qualifications and experience really drove that bargain. And so I went into the Washington Lee Alumni Office on the 1st of July, 1983, and Bill retired, and I had about a week with him. And I had known Bill and admired, I still love Bill Washburn. Bill Washburn is a man that has a zillion friends, and people think well of Bill and always will. And certainly I lead that charge. But I went in over there, and within, 1 month, 2 months of my taking on that new job, suddenly this bold new president had unleashed this great controversy for the next few years, which was the whole co-ed debate. And I was engulfed immediately. It was almost unfair because suddenly I became, along with John Wilson, the agent of change. If you can imagine how alumni would feel what's going on now at Washington Lee. New president, and my God, they've got a guy running the alumni program who's not even an alum. You can sort of understand the kind of reaction that John Wilson and I would get when we'd move around the country together. We'd talk about the blind leading the blind. I'm out there taking John to all these chapters, and he was relying on me, and I'm wandering into a minefield in practically every city in the country because of the strong feelings that people had. Now, there was a lot of support, too. but there were questions, to say the least. And I think if I hadn't have had my Williamsburg just plain public relations experience, I would never have survived that job, because those were trying times for John Wilson, more so than me, I'm sure. But I got my share of nasty phone calls too in those days.
And, what kinds of things did they say?
Well, just what are you guys doing to ruin? I resent that you're tampering with my university. How dare you sort of tell us what we know is best for our university, kind of thing. You know, sort of Johnny come lately to the scene. John was getting that, not so much me. There were just questions, I suspect, about me. I'd been there long enough to have had 2.5 years. I had been around the country in 22 cities running area campaigns, so I had enough people who knew me that knew where I was coming from. But I determined from day one, and I think my previous PR experience taught me this, to try very hard to empathize with people. I knew that the only way I could truly survive would be not simply to go down the middle on it, but to understand people and where they were coming from. Because what I learned, and I think what we all learned, was that what people brought to the debate, they took away from the debate. Logic did not work. This was an emotional issue. So it wasn't a case of convincing anyone. That's just forget it. What they came with, the way they were built, the way they thought, wasn't going to change. So I determined in my own mind what I was going to do is every time I got a phone call, and it was someone who was absolutely opposing the decision that was he felt was being made, I would take the other view and tell him all the things that coeducation, all the benefits that it could bring. Now, flip-flop, if someone called and said, "Oh my God, I'm so proud of Washington. We're finally getting in the 20th century. We're finally admitting women. Oh, praise Allah. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, John." I would say, you have to understand what the other side is feeling here. It's an emotional thing. It really is tearing to pieces. And please help us with this crowd. So I was working both sides of that street. Just as indeed John Wilson, I guess, was. John could articulate the reasons for it, for being remaining all male, better than any of the all male proponents. He could also, of course, disarm that argument, and he did.
He could articulate anything.
He would articulate both sides of it, but he would beautifully disarm his own argument for remaining all male.
You need to pop in there too.
Okay.